Hello and welcome back to The Fire Break, sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative technology to reduce the severity of wildfires. I have got Casey Gano with us today. Casey is a certified forest, a newly certified forest professional who lives up yonder in Canada, you know, the country that can't keep its smoke to itself. And Casey, welcome to The Fire Break. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So, you know, when I was looking for guests for the show, you know, I looked through everyone who is, you know, in the fire community or forest management, any of these related, closely related things. And I came across your profile on LinkedIn. And for anyone who wants to know how to do like the perfect about me, Casey really nailed it here. With a meandering story of adventure and humility and humor, which was really great. So if you're trying to figure out how to redo your LinkedIn profile, it's Casey, C-A-S-I-E, and then in parentheses, K-C, because, you know, some people like the shorter version of things, Gano, it's G-A-N-O, it's quite funny. And I hope that this shout out to your profile brings all manner of fascinating employment and adventure opportunities your way. Good. You tell the story better than I do. How did you end up in forestry?
Well, I grew up on a ranch in Alberta. So I grew up right in the middle of kind of forestry land on the eastern slopes of the Rockies. There is a mill in my town. But it was never really talked about as a viable career path. And I had no awareness of professional forestry growing up, which now kind of flabbergasted me because I was right in the thicket of it. I kind of assumed you had to be a logger to be in forestry. And so I kind of want to be a logger now, but I feel like at the time it didn't seem appealing to me. So I went into environmental sciences. I actually thought I was going to be a doctor. So my grandpa's a doctor and I thought I was going to be a doctor. And I go to university and I'm in biology. I'm going to be a doctor. This is going to be great. I then realized, you know what? There are some things here that maybe don't align as far as how I think the world works. And to me, being a doctor is an incredible gift. But the people who end up in hospitals and who are sick, mostly it's a very last ditch effort sort of thing. Anyway, I got interested in the natural sciences at that point and philosophy. So I got sucked into the humanities and I went the philosophy route, kind of thinking about, honestly, existentialism, why we're here, what is the point of all of this? And
if you found out, please let me know.
Still working on it. I'm still working on it. And I think I love both of those things. I love school. I love learning. So I basically did a double degree by the end of that. Got super burnt out through reading and writing so much and surviving varsity sports at the same time. I played volleyball through that. And It was an incredible 5 years of my life. I look back on it fondly, but I definitely burned out very, very hard. And then I went overseas to play pro for a year in Greece, and I was playing volleyball there. And after school, like just playing sports alone was totally different life. And I loved it, but it was not as fulfilling as I would have thought it would have been. So I started looking towards some other options, and a lot of my friends during university had been in wildfire. And so I started asking them some questions, and I got injured in kind of the last stretch of one of our seasons there. And I started looking for other options when I went home because I couldn't train. And wildfire interviews and things were happening and quickly approaching. And because of this injury, I was able to fly back home to Canada and make the interviews for BC Wildfire. And so I did that, flew across the world to get into this interview. ran the beep test with a broken wing and got
a broken
in.
What in
here? Sorry?
You had a broken what?
I had dislocated my shoulder. So it was just, it was sore.
It was a broken wing.
It was a broken wing, yeah. And that's how I got into Wildfire. I basically just needed a break from academics, and I wanted to still be in kind of a team environment. I wanted to work outside. I wanted to travel. Wildfire hits a lot of those boxes. And so that's how I started. And through that, that's how I learned what professional forestry was. And even in the wildfire culture, I would say it's now much more prominent, but in the Canadian model for most provinces, professional foresters or techs are not required. And so even in wildfire, it took me a while to figure out what do forest professionals do and see if that was something that was interesting to me. So over a few years of being on the crews, I was on unit crew for 3 years, and then I wanted to try paratax. So I went up to Fort St. John to try smoke jumping. And then after that season, I decided to go back to school to do a master's degree in sustainable forest management. And that kind of propels you forward to become a professional forester. And that program is essentially designed for people like me who did a sciences undergrad or a different undergrad, but then want to pursue professional forestry. And so it takes care of all of your requirements and you get slingshot into that world. And then I went back to fire after my schooling, and I'm still sort of in the fire realm. And I love fire a lot, and I love learning. And so being a forester, I think, makes a lot of sense. I best case scenario, want to combine my love of forestry and fire going forward and land management in general. And so I think I'm in a pretty good spot.
Sounds like you're in a great spot.
Yeah.
So you did become a doctor. You're basically a doctor to the forest.
I would use that really loosely, in training. Yeah, I think I'll be learning forever, but I feel very much so like a resident. I'm a doctor in residence, maybe.
So let's cut to the chase here. Philosophy and forest.
Yes.
You know, there's a long history of people turning to the woods as a location for sharpening their philosophy skills and developing their thoughts, right? Thoreau believed that, you know, he without escaping to the woods, he never would have written Walden Pond or developed many of his philosophies. And he's not alone in that. And many of the great poets developed their best philosophies in the forest as well. You nod. You've experienced this, I trust.
Yeah,
what happens to human brains when we go into the forest that makes us more calm and creative and thoughtful?
I don't know if I can explain that. It's very experiential, obviously. It's a place where kind of the noise is different. The noise is different. You hear different things. You smell different things. You're immersed. And this whole concept of forest bathing is now a thing, but it's been a thing forever. The fact that we have to talk about it as if it's something we need to go and do and prescribe to people makes me sad, but it's true. We get disconnected from our world. That we have to go work out in gyms to do things that our natural lives would have taken care of before. I mean, it's true. I do it myself, but if I was living in a way that maybe even my grandparents were living, that would just be part of my life. It would be built in. I wouldn't have to go seek it. It would just be how I lived. And for me, I think it is hard to explain, because when something feels sort of self-evident, like growing up out in the bush, I took it for granted, obviously, but it's such a big part of my identity to be outside, to be on the land, to understand it, to kind of notice things. I think you start noticing things that if you're cut off from that, you've never had the opportunity to. And so it's a beautiful thing. And I know it's just, it just happens. I think there's not really a way to be consistently angry or upset or destructive necessarily. I think maybe that's a word, to a place if you're spending time in it. If you're spending time in a place and you come to know it and you start to notice how the birds fly and what they eat and the way the ground feels and the way it smells when the sun hits it or when the clouds come over, I think you start to care about it. And in order to know about something, or to care about something, you have to know about it. And when you're outside, you just start to know through your senses. And so I think that's a really beautiful concept. I know personally for me, when I don't spend time outside, kind of the wheels fall off the bus, and all kinds of things start going downhill. Like, I don't sleep as well. I have a lower threshold for stress. I am less able to manage my like executive functioning lifestyle, you know, in a work setting. So my professional abilities decrease when I'm not spending time outside, which is another reason why it's funny I've ended up in forestry. Is just, I tried to be a couple of other things before. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I realize now, like, I was really disappointed when that didn't work out, but I get to spend time outside as part of my job now. And that is so much better for me as a person at this point. Like, until I learn how to make a well-balanced life for myself, which I'm not maybe the greatest at, I don't think going into an executive office every day would be very good for me. And I think it would cut off a large part of my identity and ability to kind of see the world in the way that I do and be creative in that. So, yeah, I think philosophy, poetry, all of the really good stuff that makes me excited anyway, comes from a place of usually some sort of inspiration from the natural world, or being in a place and like really noticing things. So, yeah, I agree. It's an essential recipe for those people and their inspiration. Mary Oliver is a big person in my brain. She would go outside every day and write her poems outside every day, and it shows. It's just, it kind of oozes out.
Right, Walt Whitman, you know, E. Cummings, you know, the big tradition. So in terms of intent, which way did it go? Did you find the forest, or did the forest find you?
I think the forest found me. I think the forest found me because I was trying to leave it, and I didn't know I was trying to leave it. But when you grow up in a place and you're all excited to get out and go and do your life, it's just so easy to take that for granted. So I don't think I intended to separate myself from it. But when I was envisioning my life, I think I was envisioning like environmental lawyer, environmental, like something, you know, and sustainable agriculture.
Don't lawyers like consume more paper than any other profession?
Well, I wanted to be able to defend, you know, sort of like land and developments, yep, maybe, or like make a, sure, better way for rural communities or indigenous communities that maybe don't get to have their say. But I recognize also you have to be the top of the cream of the crop to be the lawyer who gets to have the feel-good lawyering. Often, I think if you're a lawyer and you end up in environmental law, you're often defending pretty large projects and trying to help them move forward. And not that I'm like anti-industry or anything. I think I just realized through interviewing a bunch of lawyers that they thought one thing going into it and they were doing another in practice. And that felt, it's true. It's true. And that's the way it is. I think, I think that maybe the truth about it would be that I don't think I'd be doing the dream job I would want at the stage that I was at, kind of. And maybe now, maybe later. I know there's a few foresters who have gone to become lawyers, and I think that's pretty cool. They can do both.
Yeah, there's a software for fire management called Athena.
Yes.
And their tagline is the voice of the acre. And I think, you know, maybe as either as an environmental attorney or through any role of stewardship, you know, you become the voice of the forest, and you speak for the land and you represent its best interests, which is something that, you know, happens seldom these days, you know, and I think that globally we're paying the consequence for that, for not listening to the land and not understanding how to live with it instead of living in opposition to it. So as we look, you know, into the recent history of wildfire, there's more finger pointing about the cause of wildfires, you know, than most people would have fingers to point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the commonly named fingers is poor forest management. Left on its own, the forest has evolved to deal with fire, which happens routinely, regularly, and has for the last several hundred million years. And yet there's this homeostasis where stands separate themselves and, you know, have developed ways of growing that allow them to grow in harmony with natural fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so the accusation is that certainly in the United States, you know, in 1910, when we started putting out every fire, that we started to see fire as the enemy. We allowed tremendous overgrowth, which caused, you know, an enormous fuel debt that we pay for with mega fires, super destructive fires.
Yes.
What's your view on that? Do you feel like forest management practices have contributed, or?
Yeah, I think.
Or is it more something else?
Yeah, I think it's a whole multitude of factors, but forest management is definitely one of them. I think our cultural thoughts about the forest contribute. I think just what we were saying before, when you're not necessarily in a place and you're not necessarily noticing what a place needs or wants in regards to, say, fire, you're kind of one step removed, and then you're able to do actions to it that maybe aren't fully understanding what it needs. And so this is not new. This is not a new concept. It's just we have put ourselves first in most cases, I would say. And so we're not noticing how, in trying to do that, we're actually putting ourselves at a much greater risk. And so in the long run, trying to fill our own needs and get what we need to succeed and to build our economies and build our cities and all these things, we are putting ourselves in the line of fire, and we can't have it both ways. So I think we do need to recognize, we are recognizing by force, that we can't have it both ways. So you can have natural forests and you can let them burn, or you can let them reset, as you're saying, and we can get out of the way. And that's one way of thinking about it. Or we can try to work with it and kind of recognize our mistakes and change our management to decrease the risk. And so I would say my job now is to work on that mode, to try and work with what we have and to decrease the risk, because we have put ourselves in a greater risk category. So exposure over time, that increases your risk. We have been in a time, that ticking time bomb as far as exposure. And now we have lots of forests that are overstocked, like you're saying. They look different. They behave different. They don't have those naturally created fire breaks through fire that they did have here in the Southeast and BC here. There's a lot of good research that just clearly shows that there's a huge fire deficit here over the land base. And that's because we removed indigenous burning. We made that illegal. We stopped listening to those people who knew the land. We stopped listening to those leaders who knew the land. And it shows. I don't know. I think we have to accept that we are in a different environment and we are not going to be able to strong arm our way through those things. We have a lot of good technology. We have a good firefighting tactics. We have all of these things. It's just at a scale now that is so large that we have to recognize we are just a tiny part of this system. And the system is screaming that it needs to balance itself out. And we just need to kind of, I think, surrender to that a bit and recognize the forest will persist. I think the forest will persist. It knows how to survive. It knows how to evolve. And I think we need to ask ourselves, do we know how? It doesn't feel like it sometimes, but I think there's also a lot of really brilliant people who are very passionate, who have this hope that we do know how to evolve and we can. So I try to not be too doomsday, but I think forest management fully contributes. We can't treat it as like a timber production site at all times. There's so many values on a patch of ground that are not valued the same as maybe timber output. So that is changing, and I've seen that here. It's just a matter of getting enough people at the table who think that so that the conversation can change. And I don't know, I think we are stubborn creatures and we need to sometimes have our butts kicked to be squeezed into innovation. And I think that's happening. Like British Columbia, we've been spoiled with resources to the point that when I came into forestry school, I thought, oh, BC is the best, like leading the world in innovation. And in some cases that is true, but in a lot of cases, I don't think we've been forced to innovate. I think we've been spoiled rotten. And that also shows the number of maybe value-added mills or products that we have here, the number of smaller companies that are able to make those kind of niche products. They're, you can count them on a couple hands. So that shows me that we haven't been squeezed into innovating, and maybe that's where we're at now.
Yeah, when you look at the number of fires, you know, impacting British Columbia, it kind of takes away from the credibility of anything they say about what they know about living with the land and fire, you know, fire management and forest management. It's kind of an embarrassing slap in the face.
It is.
And it's really, right, it's very presumptuous of us the way we treat forests, because the forests have been there, as far as I know, for a couple hundred million years, and we've barely been here for 200,000 years. And then we show up and pretend like, oh, we know what to do here. Before we listen, right, that we want to make decisions before we listen to the forest, before we know how the system works, and we just plow in there. And, you know, even the name given to the people who manage this problem, firefighters, this would be like someone who works with the ocean calling themselves a tide fighter. Like, mm-hmm. you can't fight the tide. You can only work with it, and you can't fight fire. Well, you could, you know, the same way they, you know, law enforcement, you know, fights drugs. Like, okay, well, they're still everywhere. You know, how's that fight going for you? With, you know, lots of dollars spent, lots of lives lost, but, you know, not much progress really.
I think that's a really good point. I just think even our language, we just need to make some small but very important changes in how we talk about these things. And
okay, well, give me the list.
Well, you just said it, a firefighter. I think that's an outdated term. I think for maybe structural firefighting in urban centers, that still works. But for wildland fire, I'm not a fan. I know that, like,
fire mediator.
Yeah, I like being called like a fire person. I like there's some indigenous communities that I've worked with. They have, obviously it's built into their culture, but they're fire keepers. Like, there are people who are meant to do that role in the community, and they're fire keepers. And so it's just a small change, but it means a lot. And it means, yeah, it's welcoming the good parts of fire as well, and using it to your advantage, or respecting it, just respecting what it is and knowing about it and becoming some sort of student of it. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's not for everyone to change language, but I think language has a ton of power, and it changes how we think about things. And I agree with what you just said. It's like fighting crime, fighting drugs, fighting all these things. It's like, how's that going for us?
Yeah, right.
I don't know.
Is Dr. Philip, how's that working for you?
Yeah, we just need to shift. It's not a huge shift. It's just opening up new opportunities for how we think about things. It doesn't have to be one way. It can be different.
So in terms of, you said shifting how we think about things, you know, so we have people who don't think about things at all, people who think about things and think about, and people who think about things incorrectly. And it's right. It's probably, you know, that misinformation is in many cases more damaging than no information.
Yeah.
Between the time you grew up in the bush and what you've learned now, going back and doing your own personal misconception research, what are the things that you used to believe that you no longer hold true?
I think I was like born an environmentalist. Like, my family and the culture that I grew up in is more not that way. Like, I'm kind of different than my family in a lot of ways, and I think that's caused a lot of friction in my life. But it's also helped me to recognize when I'm, you know, maybe I need to be adjusted to think about like both sides of things. And so my dad's a pipeline welder. Like, there's just, I've always had to grow up with this like very stark reality of like what I believe is right and what like supports me and my whole life. Like, what allowed me to go to university to become this person that I am is like oil money. It's right. Like, and my mom being a rancher, like, there's sustainable ranching for sure, but like the beef industry is just in a lot of cases run rampant and also has a lot of problems associated with it. And so I am the product of our world. I am a walking example of what those things can be, but it just, I feel like I had a lot of misconceptions maybe as far as all logging is bad when I was a kid, or all of kind of development is bad. And through growing up in my family and in my cultures kind of in Alberta and BC, that's primarily where I've been, you just learn it's not that straightforward, and there are so many interlocking kind of needs. And because of my own privilege, I guess, I've been so fortunate to be able to live kind of pretty charmed life. Like, I got to play professional sports because my parents were willing to drive me vast distances every other day to get me to practices. Not all kids get to have that. I also got to grow up in a pristine environment that was incredible and anyone would love to grow up in. I am relatively wealthy considering, you know, the like wealth gap of this world. And
right. If you have clean water and food,
yeah,
you know,
when
you're
already in
the top 1%, right?
When I think of like misconceptions, it's just about my own existence even. It's how did you get here and what allowed you to get to this point where you can have these opportunities and think this way and have time to think this way? What I've realized a lot is I don't want to think that people think about things wrong, but I honestly have come to kind of know that some people don't have time to think about this stuff. They just are in survival mode because they have to just work to provide for their family or to get to that next kind of milestone or next meal even. And so I don't want to say that's wrong thinking. I want to say that's an unequal opportunity to have the time to think about these things. And I've been given loads of time to think about this. And I am a thinker, and I think I was a thinker as a child too, but just even reflecting on that, this isn't I am better than you and holier than thou. It's just I've been given so much opportunity to get to this point through those means that I have to take ownership of that in some way. And I'm not embarrassed about it or anything. I just think it's part of the story. Nobody's immune from it. I live a pretty easy lifestyle. I like going on vacations. I like doing these things. And so sometimes I'm challenged with my own, I don't want to say cognitive dissonance, but it can be cognitive dissonance. It can be, I believe this, and I think this is super important. We have to take action now and do these things, but I'm also going to go fly to see my friends and family and go on this vacation or whatever. And I do both of those things. And so it's a constant tension and conversation. And I want it to be a conversation. I think that's the hard part, is like, try not to turn it off because it's too hard to think about two impossible, you know, or not impossible, but hard things. And like I was saying, you can't necessarily have it both ways. And so sometimes I have to come back on myself and the things I'm talking about or preaching or really want to happen, I'm also contributing to. And so how am I going to take ownership of that? And how am I going to adjust my language or my behavior to accommodate that reality? Because I don't want to pretend like I'm not. I want to be fully immersed in the fact that
aware.
I have a very nice life. I have all the things. I can do all of the things. That's a problem. That's why we're here. How do we shift these good things towards the greater good, probably? So how do I get those people who have wrong thinking? How do I give them the benefit of the doubt and try to recognize their position to see, like, maybe they just have never had the opportunity to see a different way because of something else. Like, who am I to say? So I think for myself, it's a lot of self-reflection in, I think I'm right a lot, but there's a lot of reasons why. And they're not always straightforward. And there's a conversation to be had, usually at all levels. So which voices aren't being heard? Like, that's something I've been thinking about really recently. This is the discourse. This is what we got to do. We're charging forward. But like, who's not being heard? Like, whose voice isn't at the table? And are we missing out by not having those voices there? I don't know. I think I've had a lot of misconceptions. I think life is a lot of just eating your own words. Well, saying you're going to do one thing, ending up in another. And I think my bio, even on when you saw LinkedIn, like, I've done that so many times, and you have to recreate yourself so many times. And sometimes it's confusing for people because they're like, oh, you're different, or you changed, or like, you're so contradictory. And that is hard to listen to, but it's like, I don't want to be contradictory. I just want to be aligned with my values, I think. And it's sometimes, yeah, it's like, yeah, I did say that before. And yes, maybe I've changed my mind, And I think it's hard for people to take that because yeah. they don't like it. But for myself, I think I just have to recognize that's part of this. I have to eat my words. When I learn yeah. something new and I recognize that no longer is the case, or I don't believe that anymore, I don't want to think that way anymore, I just have to get better at doing it more often, maybe.
Yeah, I would say, you know, based on what you've said, that, you know, of all of the things that we can eat, our words have the least environmental impact.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's a process. What changes have you made? You know, your parents, you know, were big, you know, consumers of oil or beef.
Mm-hmm.
Have you moved away from either of those things in any way?
I wouldn't say no. Like, I would say I still drive my truck every day. That's not true. I try to take the bus. Like, there's a bus that comes to my little community here, and I'll try to make little differences. I would say, reflecting on my own impact, for sure, the biggest impact I have would be like air travel, for example. And so during COVID, actually, that was a big point of reflection, I think, for a lot of people. And I kind of was thinking at the early stages, I was like, you know, like, international travel might be done. And like, am I okay with that?
It's a, you know, it's really right. It's like you said, it's a trade-off and contradiction, because you might travel to an international conference, you know, okay, that whatever the carbon footprint of that is, where you might have some influence that ends up having a tremendous impact on the climate health,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, because of using your voice, you know, as right in your philosophy and your, you know, and your powers of persuasion. Right.
Yeah.
So to keep that local might really minimize your impact, you know, relative yeah. to the carbon footprint. Right. It's
yeah.
You look at all the crap that Taylor Swift's getting now. Right. Because people are tracking her flights in her private plane, you know, like.
Yeah, I think
condemnation of her, you know, by people who are driving their Ford F-150s to work every day. Right. It's a little hypocrisy. Yeah.
I think it's more so because at an individual level, that's something that comes up over and over again. It's like, I don't feel like anything I do makes a difference. And so
you don't.
Yeah, I do think you make a difference. I think you make do. A difference, but I think what we are. I try not to like self-flagellate, I guess. It's like, to some extent, yes, what we do as individuals feels very small, but it's still important. And it's more so a thought of how do I build my community or my little circle of influence to care. I think it's about caring. I think it's about noticing and caring, going back to what we said at the beginning. When you start to notice little things about a place, or you go on a certain walk every day and you know the seasons and you know those sorts of little differences, I think you can't help but care. And when you care, you're willing to see things with maybe a wider perspective. And maybe that doesn't mean we all stop air travel right now, and that's not what I'm advocating for. I'm just saying that we always have a choice pretty much in anything every day. And how are your choices, like how you speak about things, the words you use, the people you include, the community you want to be a part of. If those are kind of guiding you, then in my world, I think that's going to move a net positive idea. But I also think there's a lot of people who have a lot of power and a lot of influence that have a lot of the wealth. And so it sometimes is about kind of maybe unmasking what that is. Like, why is that the case? Asking your whys a couple times gets you to maybe the root of some of these issues. And I really don't like simplifying things, but it often comes down to our human tendency towards greed and wealth and power dynamics. And that happens at all scales. So I think when you scale that up, you're seeing that in our world right now. Our world is just, it is something that we have produced, but it's also something that we can change. So if we have got ourselves to this point, we can shift. And I don't know, I think I'm a little bit like of a, obviously like a idealist. I think I'm an idealist, but that's okay. And I definitely know how to do practical things. And I definitely value those practical things. And I have people in my life who are hammering that practicality into me every day, which is good. It keeps me honest.
Fight back.
I know. But I think,
when was the world ever changed by practical people?
Yeah, I think like maybe a mixture of both, but it's definitely worth it to have that confidence and optimism that you are an agent for whatever you want to be. You can be an agent for creativity, for advocacy, for operationally helpful things. You can do whatever you want as an agent. And so I think once you kind of have that confidence, even that is a powerful thing. And it shows to other people in your life. I think it kind of comes off of you. So there's, I don't know who's, it's been said by a lot of people, but authentic people scare people who maybe aren't, because it makes them feel uncomfortable or something. And it's, I felt like that. I felt like when you're faced with someone who's truly living in their values and are just authentic, and you're trying to be something, and you have this, like, you're trying to force your way into being a certain thing or being perceived a certain way, things kind of fall apart for you, because the realness of that person who's just being who they are and who they're created to be kind of just, it has this effect of maybe like melting away the, it's like fire. It's like a purifying thing. It's like fire. It's like, it takes this authentic thing and what it was created to be, and it just is. And the things that are kind of fabricated around it are flammable, and they melt or they burn.
Right. Trial by fire.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So I'm trying hard. It's hard because you want to construct yourself into being successful in this world and how this world creates success. And I catch myself doing that all the time, but it doesn't usually last that long. I find I'm most sustainable when I'm living as I am, who I am, with all my weird quirks and flaws and awkwardness and all that. Like, I just need to lean into that and obviously be learning and growing and maturing. But when I try to create some idealized version of what I think people want, that's when the wheels fall off the bus.
Yeah. So it sounds like you have a strong awareness of hollow victories.
Right? Yeah.
When you successfully achieve something that you think other people want, and it leaves you feeling empty.
Totally. Hollow victories, it's no good. It doesn't feel good. It's like, our world is full of noise. I don't need to add to it. Yeah.
Well, you certainly want to add your voice to it, though. You know, you were talking about the why, you know, and I think about the Anasazi tradition of the seventh generations. To me, that's the antidote to greed, is realizing that, you know, we would like to have beautiful forests for our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren to enjoy the way mm-hmm. we've enjoyed them. And if we continue mm-hmm. to mismanage them and, you know, make the environmental impact choices that we make, you know, we're stealing that from our children. And I think that, for me personally, that's been the most impactful thought on my behavior and why totally. I'm making a career in fire mitigation, not to mess with the forest. Just to really focus it on minimizing the impact of fire on the built environment. But understanding that everything on the other side of the built environment is nature's realm, and nature knows how to manage it just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, confine your influence to the areas that, that impact humans and let the forest do the forest.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. I think it's so tough because we got our hands in everything and we're all over the land. So I agree with you. It's like if we're in this situation, we've built these environments, we are in towns and cities. A lot of my focus is on the WUI, the urban interface. And so I think it's true what you're saying. But we're also part of out there. We are part of out there. And I think what you said is true. It's you're on her terms out there. You're on her terms, but I think we could do a better job of just learning from it and noticing it and working with it or alongside it and then getting out of the way when we need to get out of the way.
Yeah.
But not just saying that's that, like out there, the pristine wilderness. I don't think that as a concept has been helpful either. I think that is perpetuating maybe some of these thoughts. We are still part of it out there too. We just aren't as big a part. We need to, our emphasis on self is this big and maybe we could make it this big.
Yeah, right. And don't presume, but when we are going to have influence on the out there, you know, more thought before action.
Totally.
I used to think that the wildland urban interface was the door to my teenager's room.
Yes, so, that is true. It probably is, actually. You could do some hazard abatement in that area, probably.
Wow. Well, you know, Casey, I invited you on the show, you know, because I thought you might offer some practical tips on, you know, forest management practices, what we're doing wrong that leads to more wildfire, and what we should do less of. And we didn't really touch on that at all. Which was great because we touched on some things that were much more important. And that was the attitude with which we approach careers in this environment. And you've brought such a wealth of attention towards insightfulness, towards patience, and really towards thoughtfulness. And I love that you bring that to this space.
And thank you, Steve.
There's that is sorely needed here, right? We just tend to rush in with our best ideas, you know, before we really take the time to listen. And I can't help but feel that your bent towards philosophy has a lot of influence on the way you approach problem solving, and you seek first to understand. And that's something that we don't see much of. And then very often people who do understand, unfortunately, are so beaten down by what they've understood that it's hard for them to function. Because if you see the huge picture of it and sometimes what I might call the horror of it all, it could really be disabling. And you seem to have figured out how to stay focused on your why, you know, in a way that gives you a reason to smile every day, even though you see the enormity of the challenges ahead. So
yes, kudos I to agree. You huge, I was going to say, not without some serious wounds along the way. It definitely gets overwhelming. And there's definitely been some times where, you know, it's hard to smile, but that's okay. That's just part of it. It's a story. It and if you choose to be part of it, you just got to make your character worth it. I don't know. It's something that we're all part of here. And it's, if you're searching for your why, definitely worth the time. And that's kind of my, yeah, exactly what you said. That's what gets me going in the morning.
Well, we may have to change the spelling of your name to Casey with a Y.
There we go. Nice.
Or, you know, you found your why.
I got my why.
When I see the spelling on your name change, I'll know you found your why. But okay. I think you're there. Casey, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting me, and good luck on the next episodes.
Yeah, exactly, right? is that your philosophy? Is like always on to the next. But
no, it's not.
Moment to, taking a moment to appreciate, you know, the present.
Both. Definitely, for sure.
And they're both totally legit, right?
It's, they are legit.
The most successful people don't look backwards or sit on their laurels, right? They do what they did, and then they figure out what's the next thing to do. What's the next best step?
Totally. So,
thanks for opening my eyes to that. Thank you so much. And an absolutely delightful conversation. All right, folks, this is Casey Gano. You can find her on LinkedIn at Casey Gano. And this was really, really a lot of fun. You've been listening or watching The Fire Break. Thanks so much for joining us. The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative technologies for reducing the dangerous impacts of bad wildfires, but not all wildfires. Thanks again. I'm Steve Wolf. Take care.